episode of 2021. I am your host, Vincent Franchini from Tumblr House, here with a modulated Charles Coulomb.
Modulated?
Yeah, modulated. Yeah.
You mean like I'm being controlled or restricted?
Yeah. Like.
Why do you say that?
Because you're being controlled and restricted.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, I mean, look at you.
I can't. Well, I mean, what about me?
Look at you. You're wearing a mask.
Well, that is modulation? Is that control?
I guess you've been brainwashed to believe that that's not control.
No, this is freedom. You see, don't forget, it's not only 2021. It's also year 2 PDE.
Wait, what? PDE, what is that?
Well, it's the new method of dating. Remember, we had AD and BC. We had to get away from that, so we went to CE and BCE. And now we've got DE and PDE. And this is year 2 PDE.
Oh, post-democratic era?
Yeah.
Wow.
So like a year ago would be year 1. DE. Then year 2 DE, year 3 DE, year 4 DE, and so on.
Going
back to 1776.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, how do you feel about that?
I don't know. Am I wearing a mask? It's gotten so natural, I'm never quite sure.
Yes, you are wearing a mask, Charles.
Okay, well, I'm indoors, and I'm the only one here, so I guess I can take it off.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. I feel insecure. There's nobody else in here, is there?
No, don't feel ashamed, Charles. You're saving lives by wearing that mask.
Yeah, but I can't get infected, can I? There's nobody else here. All right, I'll do it. I don't have to wear it. There's nobody else in this room. I'm alone. The door is closed and it's locked. I'm safe. I'm operating. I'm under curfew. I'm not going anywhere. I'm not doing anything. I'm at my computer where I'm supposed to be. My masters have made it very clear what I need to be doing, and I'm doing it for them because I'm a loyal subject, servant. I don't want to use the other S word, but I obey my masters and I love them. They've freed me of my illusions.
I don't know what to say. I mean, congratulations, I guess.
Yes. Thank you. And to the degree that you've accepted the new paradigm, congratulations to you too.
Thank you, Charles.
Well, I think it's important that we all do our part. See, the coming of a new system, of a new manner of perception, of living, can't ever be easy. I mean, it's as they say, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. And so a lot, to live in the new era, a lot has to be given up. But think of what we're getting in return.
Yes. That's what I always say. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Safety, security. Knowledge that we're being ruled for our own benefit by those better than ourselves.
And that's the purpose of government, to take care of everyone.
Exactly. And now you could be governed in ways you could never have been governed before. And I, for one, am very, very happy. I'll have you know, I was at lunch today in a private setting here in Austria, and suddenly the police were at the door, and we were told to hurry up and finish as quickly as possible because there were too many people. And I went up to that officer and I said, "Thank you, sir. I'm glad for the helpful warning."
Did you really say that?
No. What I said was that I was glad the spirit of the Gestapo still lived.
No, you didn't. You didn't say that to a police officer.
Why not? Why wouldn't I? He didn't understand English. It didn't matter what I said. I could have said gabulubu.
Okay.
All right, I'm lying. I didn't say that. I didn't say a thing to him. He actually stuck his head in the door, told us to disperse, and left. But what I did say as soon as he was gone was that it was wonderful that the tradition of the Gestapo lived on, and more particularly, the tradition of the Gestapo informant.
Yeah, I know. Who's the rat, right?
Well, you know, we've got a lot of speculation going on. I'll tell you what, we found out who that boy was. Well, let's just say he won't be the only informant in town. I myself will squeal on him.
You'll squeal on the squealer?
Oh, yeah.
What'll happen to him then?
I'm not saying that happened to us, not much. The cop will drop by, look around.
Everybody will hold him down in bed, and everybody will put bars of soap in their socks and beat on him.
That might be fun. I know, a blanket party for a stoolie. Sometimes, you know, that's what they call back home street justice.
Yeah.
Again, a blanket party. No, but seriously, I was kind of taken aback by that. Not much, because, you know, everything has gotten so crazy. And of course, the masters live as they wish.
I'd be hugely unsettled. I'd be really... I'm not traumatized, but I mean, you're trying to have a relaxing day in the restaurant, and I mean, the cops.
It wasn't a restaurant; it was in a private home.
Oh, I hallucinated that, or for some reason, when you said that, I thought Cafe Vess.
No, gosh, no. Vess would never do anything like that.
Wait a minute. Private home. How many people?
12. Two more than what were permitted.
You should have just kicked two people out. And then made more noise. Say, oh, you like that? You like that?
There wasn't a lot of noise.
You should have drawn straws. Get the two people out and then make more noise to punish.
Oh, you're not nice.
I'm not nice. That's right.
It must have been somebody close, you know.
That's frustrating to me.
Well, you know, that's one thing, and not just here, but really all over the world, the spirit of the informant has reemerged. You know, the tattletale.
I've seen that in West Covina. They had the thing for the police force. Said this was back in, like, summer or the spring. You see, it says something like, you see any non-essential business activity, you report it to the police.
Oh, boy. I would have called the police and told them, I've seen some. It's the police. I thought they were supposed to be defunded.
Oh. Oh, wow.
Well, I mean,
that's true.
You can't have it both ways. You know, in our master's ideal world, the police would be around to smack people around over masks and so on. And it'd be nowhere to be seen when shops were being burned down. That's the perfect kind of policing for the morons that run the show.
Yeah.
And I mean that in a nice way.
Yeah.
Because I obey my masters. I embrace them.
Well, that's what... I'm pretty sure Babylon Bee made jokes on this regard, and I've seen it elsewhere, about Newsom, because they're letting people out of prison so that they could put in the people who aren't wearing masks.
Makes perfect sense. Governor Newsom will lead the charge.
Yeah. Oh,
I have visions of him, of being stuck with him in a prison like the one in The Walking Dead.
That's a scary thought.
Yeah, I think so, too. Hey, Governor, why don't you just put your hand out that window there and see if anybody bites it? Ooh, that zombie bit the hand that fed it. All at once. No, I mean, all kidding aside, it really is nonsense. You know what's going to be very difficult to understand in this coming year? This pandemic will pass. They all do. Even if there were no vaccine at all, it would pass.
Yeah.
But through what mechanism will our masters surrender the power that they've taken to themselves?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, they've arrogated all this power to themselves. How are they simply going to say one day, all right, you can do what you want now?
Is that a rhetorical question?
No, it's not. It's not a rhetorical question.
Well, why do they need to surrender?
Well, because they're exercising it. Let me put it this way. If I had you delivering my breakfast every morning, right?
Yeah.
And you were doing it because I was sick.
Yeah.
And eventually I got healthy again. Just how would I get to the point of being able to tell you, stop bringing me my breakfast every day, I'm fine? Because you know what? It's a lot of fun having breakfast brought to you.
Yeah.
So how would I give that up?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Why? How would they? Like, why and why would
they? Well, I don't know.
Do they have to?
Apparently not. We live in the post-democratic era. And they've attributed these powers to themselves without any reference to constitutions or laws. California, for instance, the governor is doing all this stuff under a mandate from the state legislature, which ran out. And the state legislature is supposed to be the ones who allow him to do this, but they're not in session. You know, they're busy going to their own beauty parlors and French laundries. So as a result, the state of California, the government of the state of California at this moment, is a criminal body. Now, when there's no one to enforce the law, that doesn't mean anything. No one's going to stop him from doing what he's doing, and no one's, you know, mutatis mutandis. It's a little bit like the election laws in the various states that altered them for the sake of this election we just had. These changes were made by governors, judges, and attorneys general of the states, but not by the state legislatures, who under the Constitution are the only ones who have the right to make those choices. But it was done anyway, and everybody's got along with it. So, you know, if Al Capone's your mayor, your law doesn't mean a whole lot.
But he kept everyone safe.
He did keep everyone safe. Well, not everyone. Some people were bad and had to be punished.
Right.
But the people who played ball, they were okay. They were fine.
Yeah.
So there wasn't a problem. I mean, your Uncle Giovanni used to say that Al Capone knew what he was doing.
And he was right.
Yeah. He said, a man to emulate. And, you know, I once read an interview in Liberty Magazine with him, how Al Capone would run this country. And he was very conservative, you know. He was against porn. He was against this. He was against that. He said smut, but he was against all that. And if he'd been running the country, there would have been an end to smut. I'm sure there would have been, too, and not in a nice way. So are you going to get a court injunction against the pornographers, President Capone? Court injunction? No, I think right now the situation calls for a little, you might say, direct action. I wouldn't want to bother the courts. They're busy. Courts have a lot of other things going on. We'll take care of it. Don't worry. Well, what do you plan to do with the pornographers, President Capone? Well, you know, so much in life is a question of balance. You know what I'm saying? It's a question of returns, diminishing returns, expanding expectations. So what do you do when you've got a pornographer who's making money hand over fist? You blow his brains out. Poof. Problem solved. And in this administration, that's how we're going to take care of this stuff. law and order. Well, President Capone, don't you think, as President of the United States, President Capone, don't you think you should pay some attention to the Constitution at some point? Of course, of course. The Constitution is the very bedrock under which our entire system functions. But you know, sometimes a system needs a little extraordinary help. It's very true. Normally, you're not sick. You're well. You're fine. You eat, you drink, you go to sleep, you go to work in the morning, everything's okay. But then you get sick. And what happens? Sometimes you need radical surgery. What do? You get your radical surgery. And then as soon as you can, you go back to the normal routine. That's what the Constitution is like. It's our normal routine. And of course we all revere it. Of course we want the Constitution to be intact. But sometimes you need some radical surgery. You know what I'm saying? Now there are certain groups in this country, I'm thinking not just of the smart people, but others, that require a certain radical surgery. That's all. It's medicinal, you might say. Now that's how President Capone would have dealt with so many issues.
I like that more. It's kind of, it's simpler.
Oh, yes, yes.
Straightforward, yeah.
Yes. That's one of the things your uncle really liked about the whole idea, was that it was so simple. You know, he says, all my life I've had to go through courts. I've had all the system. Wouldn't it be easier to do it Capone's way? You hold a gun to a man's head, then you ask him, really, is that what you want? If he's smart, he says, I've changed my mind. If he's not so smart, he doesn't have much of a mind left to change. That's how that works.
Oh, okay.
What? So he was speaking poetically.
Ah, I get it.
Listen, nothing ever stuck to your uncle. The man was Teflon. It was a pleasure for me to work with him, I can tell you. Everything I know about that kind of thing, Sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
For those of you listening through iTunes or whatever, I'm zipping my lips to clue Charles in. Loose lips sink ships.
Sink ships.
Okay.
That's right. Well, and you know, that's what happened. You remember, oh gosh, God help us, it's 30 years, 40 years ago now. Since, before Tumblr House, when you had the Franchitti holding, you remember the former accountant vanished.
Yeah, poof.
Loose lips sink ships. Yeah, poof. Well,
nobody knows what happened to him.
Nobody knows. And I asked your uncle at the time, I said, what happened to Mr. Ganicotti? And he said, loose lips sink ships. That's all he ever said to me about it. You look just like your uncle, you know, when you did that. It's good to see the blood runs true.
All right, let's move on to the memes of production.
Now, I'm not going to do what I normally do. I've been held to account. I've been punished. I've been bad.
That's actually true. Tell us what happened, Charles.
Well, you know, at this point, ladies and gentlemen, normally I would throw my fist vigorously in the air as a friend of the working people across the globe and say, nationalize the means of production, to which Don Vincenzo would reply, for the common good. But we're not doing this because I found out, although it's since been altered, that in my Wikipedia article, someone had said that despite being an outspoken critic of socialism, Coulomb has called for the nationalization of the means of production. Now, that leads me to wonder if the guy understood what that meant or if he was illiterate.
And that's true, too. This is a matter of public record. If you go to Charles Coulomb's article on Wikipedia and if you have an account with Wikipedia, you can click View History, and it's right there. I feel like it's like a critic of Charles Coulomb who kind of vaguely, like, kind of skips through, kind of looking for the things that you say that he hates. And he notices the timestamp, oh, memes of production. And then he watches it for 2 seconds. And so then he catches that, and then he decides to put it on Wikipedia because it sounds like, oh, well, he critiques socialism, but then he kind of jokes about it, too.
That calls for the memes of production to be nationalized.
Yeah.
What's that all? Makes you wonder if he knows what memes of production are. He probably confuses them with their real-world equivalent, means of production. They sound very similar. It's almost as though we had been making a pun and that somebody was too stupid to pick up on it. Or it could be that one of our fans was having a gag.
Could be.
Yeah, could be. But either way, for this very first episode in the year 2 PDE, I am not going to do it. We may go back next week, but not this week.
My favorite Wikipedia gaffe for your page was when, probably about maybe 10 years ago or so, when it called you the religious and historical author.
Yes, that was good.
You have no idea what that means. Like, religious and historical. Is he someone from many years ago? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Well, it means I've got a religion. I'm religious. And I'm an historical figure. I'm religious and I'm historical. Well, and the other one I liked that came and went was that I was the recipient of the Donald T. Sterling Judeophilia Award.
What?
Yeah.
I don't believe you, actually.
Look, don't take my word for it.
Oh, Charles. I feel stupid looking this up.
Don't.
Charles Coulomb, Donald T. Sterling.
Yeah.
What kind of award? Filial what?
Judeophilia.
Judeophilia. I don't see it. It's not there.
Well, it was, I assure you.
So, what was that about, Charles?
Well, I don't know because, of course, I don't know who put it in. But Donald T. Sterling was a very wealthy real estate man in Los Angeles. He owned the Clippers as well.
Yeah.
And there was a big scandal about him a few years ago. Although he had mistresses from every race on earth, he was accused of being racist.
Yeah.
And before that time, though, he had these really clunky and really stupid ads in the LA Times. Mm. And they were basically all of them about how Donald T. Sterling was getting the Donald T. Sterling Award for the Donald T. Sterling Foundation. They'd be full page or half page color ads. And there he'd be with these second, third, fourth tier celebrities, all smiles, black tie affair, getting this thing. I mean, it's obvious he wanted to come across as respectable. It was also obvious he was doing his own PR. And, ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know, just as they say someone who represents themselves in court has a fool for a client, if you're doing your own PR, you're a fool.
And so, yeah, he got kicked out of the NBA for being racist. And he had, even though he had his mistresses, I feel like he was racist in various ways. Or he had some weird things, but
having so many mistresses is kind of weird.
Well, I mean, it's like, I mean, if you're a slaver and you're sleeping around in that way, what is it, Jefferson style? I mean,
yeah,
it's pretty weird, right?
I would have thought so, but then he's the father of our country.
Okay, I'm not going to get into that. All I wanted to say. Was the NAACP gave Sterling an award.
They and did.
That's one of the things. They kind of just, no one wants to talk about that. But it tells you that these organizations are bought out so easily.
What? What?
Yeah. Yeah.
I myself got the Donald T. Sterling Judeo-Philia Award. You think, oh, wait a minute. That never happened. Oh, forget it. But Donald T. Sterling, I think, is a prisoner of conscience.
All right, let's go on to the memes of production. I don't want to hear this prisoner of conscience stuff.
You don't?
No.
You used to care for people who were suffering for their beliefs.
I know. I'm a POW in the war on poverty, Charles.
A deserter from the Salvation Army. That was a great line. Yeah. I'll never forget that one.
All right, let's do these memes. Let's get through this. All right, first one is from Raul, who sent this through Twitter.
Okay.
Oh, very cute. The Don and the Con, and a picture of a little bunny and a guinea pig.
Yeah,
in sort of the style of the post that you do when you're trying to calm everyone down with your saccharine poisoning.
saccharine poisoning, listen to you. To make this clear, ladies and gentlemen, on my private Facebook page, let me emphasize that, I don't really tolerate arguments that go into ad hominems or sheer insults of each other. I won't take that. And when a topic comes up that gets so bad that I've just gotta dump the whole thing, which I do, I'll then start running pictures of cute little animals to calm everyone down. I mean, obviously, if people are getting too upset set to talk like big people, like big grown-up, then what I do is I give a bunny, the duckling, the little chicks, the puppy, the kitties, and then they can you know, calm down. Because, like, it's hard when you can't talk like a grown-up and you got to yell and scream and call names. And so when they start acting like little people, I know it's time for tackling.
You know, you just gave me the idea of just $1 million idea. A reality TV show where you're teaching students, you're maybe high school or college, and you're running the show, basically. It's like your antics. It's like you're just doing all this crazy stuff. And then people just sort of have to deal with this teacher from outer space. Yeah.
What crazy stuff are you talking about?
I don't know. Your jack-o'-lantern type shenanigans where, I mean, you're probably going to treat people like literal babies. If they're gonna act bratty, you're gonna treat them in an over the top fashion.
No, I would never do that to my little ones. No, I give them comfort they need. The fact that their little bodies are 20 years old and their little minds are 20 months, but there's a little disparity there, and they need care. Now, how would that be over the top?
Well, I stand corrected, I guess.
Thank you very much. I'll have you know, I was dealing with some students with regard to American history, and they didn't have, because they went to American schools, they had no background in history or literature or anything else. So to try to expand their understanding and their knowledge of American literature alongside the teaching of the history from my book, Puritan's Empire, available from Tumblr House. In addition, I had them go online and read Classics Illustrated comics, because I found over many years that they're pretty good representations of the novels being described. And I assigned them comics from that pertain to that era that they happened to be studying. Well, they did find it a little bit strange to be reading comic books, but they really do. The Classics Illustrated do give a very good impression of that era. Of the era that we're being dealt with. So then, in order to allow them to understand the American bias against monarchy, I had them watch Schoolhouse Rock, No More Kings. Now, these are college students.
Yeah.
So, you know, first they're getting the comic books. Now I've got them reading. I've got them watching Schoolhouse Rock.
I love Schoolhouse Rock. All of them.
I do. Yeah, but that's beside the point. They, you know, they were like, what? I said, all right, gentlemen, I understand. I understand how you feel. I want you to know that I completely respect your maturity and your adulthood. I don't want you to think that you're being patronized in any fashion whatsoever. Now, your Constitutional Convention coloring books should be here by the end of the week. I'll send you a list of the crayon colors I want you to use. They roared. They, what?
You know, it occurred to me that in it, because you were telling me that the multiplication tables are kind of getting abolished, or, you know, they're not being taught anymore. So, truly, the math episode of Schoolhouse Rock would truly be educational.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of it would be a bill that describes how a bill goes through Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, the sad thing is that Schoolhouse Rock, which was meant for elementary school children, would be good introductory material for college-age kids now. And I'm saying that without a giggle.
Yeah.
We have become a national nursery. We're run by little woo-woos, and we've been turned into it by our masters. They are the stupidest bunch of tyrants that ever ruled the planet.
Well,
I'm not saying that's a bad thing, however.
We're taking all of our intelligence and we're putting it into machines so we don't have to use our intelligence anymore.
Yeah. All we have to do is use our arbitrary decisions, which you'll have to obey because we can force you to.
All right, moving on. We have a meme from Peter on Twitter.
Peter, thank you. Let's see what we got.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, last episode, I'm your mental hygiene czar / enabler. And you are mentally sane approved. Thinking of bunnies. You, I like that. I love that capture where it looks like you're really, truly thinking of bunnies. I love that.
Yeah, and the bunnies are really into it. So I'm sane and you're in charge.
But there's, wait, there's more. Meanwhile, out the door, there is chaos. Everything's on fire and people are rioting.
Yes, but I'm sane. Bunnies.
Well, that's how we get through this.
That's for sure.
A positive attitude and real thick steel doors.
I can't argue with that. Positive attitude and real thick steel doors. And a security team with orders to shoot to kill. You know, I feel so secure. Yeah, I'm sure. You know, years ago when, what was his name? The mayor of New York, not Dinkins. Oh, gosh.
Oh, not Bloomberg or?
No. It was before Giuliani. He was not a very good mayor. He was a Jewish guy. Funny. Mm-hmm. He was a funny, funny guy. He actually guested on as a judge on the People's Court once. Oh, golly, what was his name? It was before. Ed Koch. That's who it was. Ed Koch. So, Ed Koch, the city was falling apart. The crime rate was huge. People were getting mugged on the subway right and left.
When is this, during the 70s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they interviewed Ed Koch riding the subway to work one morning. And they said, well, Mr. Mayor, you know, you get up at 5 and get on the subway. Aren't you afraid of being mugged or attacked? He goes, oh, no. My guard here has a gun. So
did he say that jokingly or just like?
No. Now, there was his guard standing there, and you knew he was armed. And, you know, if anybody had given the mayor a guff, it'd have blown him away. And, of course, it's illegal to own handguns in the city of New York. Has been since 1876, the Sullivan Act. Again, what's good for our masters is not always good for us. What good would it be giving sheep means of self-defense? Exactly. Gotcha there, smart guy. Any defense that's needed will be provided by the ownership. And of course, every now and then the wolves snag a few sheep, but doesn't matter. You figure that in when you're setting up a profit margin, you see. You figure you'll lose 3 or 4 sheep a season to wolves, so that's, you know, that's fine.
Makes sense.
Well, see, I know it cooks.
All right. Gratuitous plug, become a patron for as low as $5 a month. Get double the content. Get our pre-shows. So much more content. We had another one. I think it was about 45, maybe 50 minutes long. Another really good one. Talked about a lot of interesting things. Benedict Arnold, for one. Interesting story of Benedict Arnold.
Yeah.
What is it? What are we else? The fall of the Soviet Union. The Latinization of countries. It's a lot of really interesting topics on this pre-show. So don't miss out. Lowest $5 a month. Yeah.
Operators are standing by.
Act now. Void were prohibited. Sorry. No CODs.
Act now while supplies last.
This could be your last chance to give us $5.
Not an actor. But wait, there's more.
Okay.
That's right, Vinny.
Gosh, I love that. I love that. And whenever I feel like whenever people like become huge fans of yours, it's like they're brainwashed and like they're these robots that go out preaching the gospel of Tumblr House with the whole spiel. Yeah, I love it. I just love it.
Well, you know, it's funny. If you could have seen the ads when they first started using those phrases back in the 60s, yeah. The late night ads. Man, they were so enthusiastic. It was like the greatest thing that ever happened.
Yeah.
It didn't matter what they were selling. They were just so enthusiastic about it.
There's still good ads. There's still some really funny ads out there. I like the one. My favorite ad is the one. It sort of is a Q-tip replacer. You know, it's like, and they show a demonstration of someone trying to use a Q-tip, and he like puts it in his ear, and he's like, "Oh, oh!" Like, what? I'm not joking at all. Anyone who's, you can find this, I'm sure. I forgot what it's called.
Well, that's
but
sad.
It was great. I love it. Oh man! All right. All right, let's move on to the questions. Enough okay. Joking around. People want the serious discussion.
People want answers, and they want them now.
Yeah. We're going to give it to them, good and hard.
Oh, boy. Then maybe we can go back to the jokes.
All right. All right. First question is from Theo.
Okay, Theo.
Please, could you describe Abwehr? Wait, how do you say it? Abwehr. Abwehr.
A-B-W-E-H-R. Abwehr.
There we go. And U-boat activity in the United States territory during World War II, was it more significant than historians have tended to believe because of the suppression of information regarding enemy activity on American soil by the U.S. government?
Well, that's a good question. Obviously, If the information was suppressed, I wouldn't know about it. I will say that there was certainly Abwehr, that's German military intelligence agents, operating in the United States. We caught a lot of them because, frankly, they really weren't as good as their KGB equivalents. Soviet penetration of the United States was always much more effective than Axis. I don't know why that was, but it was. Possibly because the Soviet Union lasted a lot longer than Nazi Germany. That might have played part of the thing. But there were in New York and St. Louis and other places, Los Angeles, Nazis and Nazi sympathizers. The German consuls general in those cities were not only centers of propaganda, but also of information gathering. And certainly in Washington, just as the British tried to use whatever influence they could put together to get congressmen and such to push for war, the Germans did the same against it. I had a very strange experience in that I read a book that came out in the 50s about German intelligence operations in D.C. during the war and the various things they did to try to push government figures away from war. And then I read a biography of Roald Dahl, the children's writer, Norwegian fellow. You know, he did James and the Giant Peach, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. And Roald Dahl, during the war, he was Norwegian, but he was a British intelligence operative in Washington. And same thing. And it was funny because reading what he and his cohorts did to try to get government figures to push the country into the war, and reading it in juxtaposition with this other book, what Germans and so on were trying to do to push us, to keep us out of it. You read the two books side by side, and you feel like, you know, was anybody in Washington interested in the United States at that point? I mean, I don't mean the agents on either side. I mean, you know, because you hear about these politicians that they were courting, and it seemed like they were in their pockets. You know, the other thing too is that just as take Los Angeles, for instance, on the one hand, you had German-American organizations that were working for the Nazis in LA, propaganda and various other things. You also had British organizations that were illegally recruiting from 1939 to 1941. In fact, one I'm a member of today. And there was a British recruiting office in the Roosevelt Hotel on Hollywood Boulevard, which was completely illegal. But the feds turned kind of a blind eye to it because, of course, Mr. Roosevelt was keen on getting into the war and helping the British any way he could, which Churchill mistakenly thought meant that Roosevelt was pro-British. He wasn't. Anyway, they found that out later. But at any rate, so that was an interesting episode. As far as the U-boats go, there are a lot of anecdotal stories about, anecdotal as a rule. There are stories about U-boats and their crews and their various adventures on the American coast. Because they were destroying American shipping, you know, in Long Island Sound, and very close to our shores. So I've heard stories, how true it is, I don't know, but I've heard stories that on the one hand, German U-boats were put into various remote harbors and so on Long Island, and then go into towns with counterfeit U.S. dollars, and go to the movies and things like that. Partly spreading counterfeit bills to help, help ruin the economy, but also see the flicks, maybe grab a malted, you know, that sort of thing.
A couple counterfeits at the movies ain't going to break the economy.
No, but every little bit helps. And then the other story of that sort I've heard. In Palm Beach, Florida, a town I know pretty well and I'm very fond of, there's a restaurant that goes back to just before the war, which I'm very fond of, called Taboo. And supposedly, during the war, U-boats would pull into the Indian River, and their officers would change into evening dress and go and dine at Taboo. And I had, you know, when I first heard that story, I had visions of some Palm Beach dowager, you know, Captain von Holzendorf. Why, with this dreadful war on, I thought we wouldn't be seeing much of you, but here you are. This is delightful. Please, another bottle of champagne for the captain. How are you, my dear? How is Daisy?
Hey.
Who knows?
All right. Question from Jake.
Okay.
Gentlemen, as a frequent listener and new patron, I want to thank you so much for the joy and fun Off the Menu brings into my week. In addition, I recently received an order of books from Tumblr House with a wonderful note and holy card. So my thanks to Don Franchini, in whose honor I have composed the following.
Oof.
Wow. All right. 'Twas the day after Christmas when all through these digs, not a creature was stirring, not even the guinea pigs. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that my Tumblr House order soon would be there. And Mama in her kerchief, and I in my cap, too, had just settled in for an episode of Off the Menu. When out in the street there arose such a clatter, I sprang outside to see what was the matter. And what to my wondering eyes did appear but a USPS truck drawing ever more near. The little old driver gave me a box with a sigh and said, I bet you paid a lot on shipping for this guy. But I laughed as I returned to my door and said, don't you see? At Tumblr House, orders over $25 ship free. The driver was stunned and looked at me riveted, but I warned him, no CODs and void were prohibited. And I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, now that's a reason for a Merry Christmas, all right. Wow, Jake, what a beautiful poem there.
That's wow. It is void where prohibited, too. That's true.
Love those rhymes. All right. Thank you for that. So his question, Charles, what books do you recommend one read to learn more about the theology and philosophy of monarchy? I know of Aquinas' De Regno and Dante's De Monarchia, as well as your own writings on the subject. But are there any others you consider to be invaluable to understanding monarchy?
Oh, yes. I would definitely go to a website called Tumblr House, where they have the extended bibliography from Star Spangled Crown. And I have a lot of very, very key books, including one that I think you're beginning to carry.
Right. Yeah, we talked about this. So one of our fans had a podcast on YouTube, and he was reviewing books a while ago. And he reviewed one book that really caught my eye, and I'm interested in reading myself, Sacred Royalty, From the Pharaoh to the Most Christian King, by, how do you say that?
Jean Annie.
There we go.
Jean Annie.
So I'm going to put this in the bookstore. I say this, it's not in the bookstore yet, but I'm going to put it right now in time for this show. It sounds really interesting. What did you think of this, Charles? You told me you read this?
I read it, and it's not, actually, I believe it's on the bibliography.
Oh.
It's an interesting take because Ani is a fellow who got into various weird occult stuff and then returned to the church.
Hmm.
And he's written books on church architecture, on the church and art, things like that, and on liturgy. But this, specifically on monarchy, and he deals with the ancient world to the present, to the most Christian king, that's the King of France. And just as the Habsburgs had their method of devotion that was called the Pietas Austriaca, the Austrian Piety. The French kings had their own, which was called the Religion Royale, the royal religion. And what he points out is that there is a sort of continuity in mankind's dealing with the sacred side of monarchy. It goes all the way back to the pharaohs. You know, it's like he doesn't quote this because the original's in French, but it's like the old Welsh triad. Three sacred things, scholars, graves, and kings. And we tend to forget the idea that governance can have a sacred side to it. The closest we come is the inauguration.
Okay. I'm going to do something impromptu. Let's see if it
works.
Spontaneous.
You said spontaneity had to be carefully planned.
I'm going to share desktop for you so you can see what's going on, Charles. And I'm going to show you Tumblr House website. Oop, let me bring this up.
That's me. Yay.
That's you. Here we go.
Why did I look younger years ago?
So let's see here. Is this work? Oh, wow. It's cool. This is great. Wow, the Tumblr House website. This is incredible. Look at this. Wow, this is so easy to use. What an incredible website. Okay, so, wow, I'm excited now. I've never done this before. So let's go to authors, Charles Coulomb, right at the top. Oh, this is his page. Up, Star Spangled Crown. And then, whoa, wow, it's on sale from $17.95 down to $13.95. You could save $4 if you buy this book, right? Whoa, buy it with Puritan's Empire, add both to cart. You click this button, and it's going to be only $38.90, and you get free shipping and handling. But wait, there's more down here. See this? You click this button right here, click write review. You type your name in, like Vincent F., and then you put your email. See that? And just say, amazing book. Wow. I can't believe how good this book is.
I don't think you're going to take your own reviews seriously.
And then you click submit, and you will get a discount code in your email instantly for $5 off on top of free shipping and handling. What a deal. Okay, anyhow. Sorry, I just get lost in all this amazing stuff on our website. I'm sorry. All right, so extended bibliography. This is how you get to it from that page. So what do we got here? We've got Thomas B. Olson, The Royal Hunt in Eurasian History. We've got a lot. This goes on and on.
It's pretty long.
Oh, we've got The End of Democracy by Christoph, published by Tumblr House. The Framework of a Christian State. I was just literally reading this last night. We talk about this so often. This book is, I don't know if it's being published by anyone. I have an old copy. This book is so important. Let's see here. Oh, Ralph Adams Cram also wrote The End of Democracy. We publish his, what is it, Gold, Frankincense, and Myrrh?
If you look, it's right down below it.
Oh, yeah, there we go. That's right. We've got a lot of Ralph Adams Cram, Joseph de Maistre, Kenelm Digby, which you keep talking about. I need to read this. Now, these actually, Mores
Cattolici.
Yeah, or Ages of Faith. That is available online for free.
So is the Broadsword of Honor.
Yeah. So there's a lot of... Oh, wait, Chivalry here. Oh, you're right. Here's Sacred Royalty. There it is. Yeah. Let's see. You see anything? Democracy, the God That Failed. Economics and Politics of Monarchy, Democracy, and Natural Order. Wow, that's a new publication, too. Looks interesting. Yeah. Arthur Machen. You always talk about Arthur Machen.
Yeah.
Thomas Molnar is another big name. The Counter-Revolution. Your buddy, Father Aidan Nichols. These are so many books. Gary Potter, In Reaction. Let's see. Vladimir Soloviev. Russia and the Universal Church. You always mention that. Wow, so many books. Have you really read all these books, Charles?
Yeah, I sure have. Every single one.
Wow. Okay, so, I mean, you guys have your work cut out for you on this one. This is a lot to read. Anyhow. Okay, enough of that. Let me close out of this. Even though it's been a fun journey on the Tumblr House website, it's always a fun journey.
Sure, always a fun journey on the Tumblr House website.
All right, there we go.
And, you know, I have to say, looking over those titles, honestly, if you read everything in that extended bibliography, it's a lot of reading, gang, a lot of reading. But, you know, I'm gonna confess something to you that probably no one else my age has ever told you. If you want to know enough to have a decent opinion about something, you've got to read a lot.
You know, I have to give a caveat on that because it's frustrating for me. You know, you work with working with a lot of non-Catholics. You know, all those subjects I read a lot on, you know, spirituality, philosophy. And I haven't read it much in history, but I can tell you I know a lot more about history than the average person on the street.
Yeah, sure, that's true. It's not hard.
It's not hard.
If you know the day you were born, you're already halfway there.
You know, all these topics are verboten, which sucks. You know what I mean? Like at the office cooler, or, you know, at the water cooler. You know, you're not talking about, you know, De Regno and Aquinas and
they do it. They do it at Tumblr House Tower.
They do. But, you know, I'm speaking of people in general. You know, most people, you know, are in diverse workforces, and it's just a frustrating thing. I can see how it's a frustrating thing, but yeah.
Well, it again, you know, there are two comebacks that I've had thrown at me my whole life long, and I've never thought they were very smart comebacks. If I make an assertion about something.
What?
Or more likely, defend an opinion. You've always got an answer for everything. Now, how is that really a rebuke? It means I know what I'm talking about.
I know.
And the other one is, oh, well, you just say that because you've studied it.
That's impressive.
Yeah, shut me up. But I'm sorry I know stuff. I apologize.
But, you know, it makes sense for not only, you know, religious discussions to be difficult, but philosophical and historical to be difficult at large. Because if we were decent on these topics, we could have avoided a lot of traps, you know? Like, we can't even go back to the history as it relates to communism. You know what I mean? Like, we're going into... Yeah, we...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, yeah, Charles has got his mask on because I don't know why. I think he just needs to feel safe right now.
I do. You said the C word.
It's disturbing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't forget how many in the past summer, how many idiotic morons, my age and younger, from universities, have been saying how wonderful communism is.
You know,
look at the three weird sisters of Black Lives Matter.
No.
They're pretty in a way.
I'm not going to look at them because saying crazy things doesn't get you the privilege of being looked at in my book. You know what I mean? Like, okay, you said crazy stuff. What you deserve then is to be shunned and to be avoided and to be ignored, not examined thoroughly.
Well, it has to be said, though, that their cause has been championed despite their being self-proclaimed Marxists. And the thing is, that's rather like being a self-proclaimed flat earther. And my apologies, incidentally, to flat earthers out there.
But what I was going to say about communism, we're getting a lot of interesting comments in relating to distributism. And these communists keep giving us comments that they prefer distributism to capitalism. How do you feel about that?
Oh, well, you see, what is capitalism? I mean, a lot of people would make the claim that distributism is real capitalism because it guarantees a truly free market with real competition, as opposed to state monopoly capitalism, the sort we have now, or crony capitalism, as it's also called, which in turn sponsors a bunch of quasi-socialist George Soros sort of things. I mean, is George Soros a capitalist? Well, yeah, in the sense that that's how he's made his money and continues to make it. What about Bill Gates? Is the dominance of an economy by people like that capitalism?
And what about Dark Lord Jeff Bezos?
Well, there's him too, who fortunately is beginning to run into a certain kind of grassroots competition, at least.
Yeah.
The Google.
I stumbled upon something as an advertiser and businessman. There's a lot of traction that we're getting through Google ads through the. So you know when you search on Google, there's an image tab, news, shopping. Well, you don't have to shop on Amazon anymore. You can search it up on Google, click that shopping tab, and that's going to give you access to a host of independent sellers, hopefully. Yeah. And I think this is something it's working out for Tumblr House right now, I'm happy to say. And I think it's going to work out for a lot of other businesses because, to be honest, I can speak from the other end because I've dealt with a lot of other businesses. Everyone's sick of dealing with Amazon. Because for a lot of reasons, I could write like a 10-page paper on this, but in short, they're getting more autocratic in a lot of different ways. And so,
well, see, that goes back to a lack of competition and a lack of a free market.
Right.
Amazon has had a monopoly.
And there was a retort, well, I don't trust Google. Well, that's true. I don't, Google isn't to be trusted as well, but two different companies is a lot better than one. And Google, as an advertiser and not as a retailer itself, I think that's a huge step in the right direction. And I hope a lot of other smaller companies take advantage of it. So if you have a small company, a lot of entrepreneurs out there, try Google shopping ads and see how it works for you. Highly recommend it. Okay.
That'd be good.
Yeah. Question from Nicholas. Hello, gentlemen. I was hoping that Charles could take some time to talk about the Russian Civil War from the perspective of the White Army. Any important events that occurred or some brief biographies of important leaders such as Alexander Kolchak, Lever Kornilov, Mikhail Drozdovsky, or any you would like to discuss. I understand this is a rather broad topic, but I'm interested in knowing how Charles sees the white movement and how he feels about the events that occurred and at least a few of the leaders. Of course, with the permission of Vincent, the guinea pig devourer Franchini.
Well, that's a very good question. Firstly, for those who aren't aware, as we know, in 1917, Tsar Nicholas II abdicated and was replaced by the provisional government, led by a man called Alexander Kerensky. And then in late October, early November, it's called the October Revolution, but that's because the old style calendar, in the new calendar, is in November. They still call it the October Revolution. In 1917, after General Kornilov, who you mentioned, attempted to push Kerensky's government a bit to the right by leading a march on the capital, was defeated. The communists under Lenin took power in St. Petersburg and Moscow. And this, they effectively had control of the most built-up part of the country. But the rest of the country was in the hands of local officers and so forth, the white armies. So it was whites versus reds. And it was a very complicated civil war because in addition to the two combatants, you also had a great many local people. The Ukrainians, Belarusians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Estonians, people fighting for local independence, Armenians, Georgians, and so on. In addition to that, you had foreign intervention. The Germans and Austrians defeated the Russians militarily as a result of the revolution in 1918. And they proceeded to occupy a big chunk of eastern Russia. And then the Allies, the British, the French, the Americans, the Japanese, the Italians, intervened in different areas in Russia to try to shore up the whites. So you had, it was very confusing. You had all sorts of things going on at once. Admiral Kolchak was the overall commander of the White Armies, and he was based in Siberia. But you had a lot of local leaders because you had several different fronts. The Southern Front, what's now Ukraine, and Crimea, you had first General Denikin, and then his replacement was General Wrangel. You had General Yudenich in what's now Estonia. General Miller up in the north around Archangel and Murmansk. But one by one, these were defeated by the Reds because they controlled the center of economics, transportation, communications, and materiel, you know, military materiel, guns and so forth. They had the industrial heart of Russia from the very beginning. It so happened that Kolchak, they had a group of Czechoslovak prisoners. They had been Austrian troops. The Russians captured them and turned them into allies. But then the revolution broke out. And so they allied with the White Army until, to get out of Russia, they made a deal and they captured Alexander Kolchak, the admiral, and gave him to the communists, who killed him. So this was not a nice thing for the Czechoslovak Legion to do. But they did get back to Czechoslovakia, so they got what they wanted, I guess. But after Kolchak's death, the Siberian front collapsed fairly quickly. Interestingly enough, when I was a boy, we had a lot of white Russians still alive. Because after the communists took over, the white Russians fled in large numbers to Shanghai, Paris, Constantinople, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. These all became very big white Russian centers. And there was still a lot of them left when I was a kid. And in fact, one of our family friends was a fellow named George Samsonovich Dumbadze, who was the chief of intelligence to Admiral Kolchak, and had a lot of wild stories to tell about the Russian Civil War. So what about the whites? Well, the whites had several problems. One of them is that they were not unified in ideology, in what they were trying to accomplish. All that really bound them together was their opposition to the Reds. And this made for a lot of weakness. It also made for personality conflicts that didn't help. In Siberia, sad to say, the American intervention actually was more trouble than it was worth for the whites, because a lot of the American troops were sent over were Russian, ethnic Russians, who were communist and had left Russia in the 1905 rebellion. The second in command of the unit was funneling troops to the local Reds. So that they could have done without our intervention, I'm afraid. But that was the story. I mean, the Japanese attempted, they occupied Vladivostok, and they attempted to seize part of Siberia, but that didn't work out well. And then eventually the last city, Vladivostok, fell to the Reds, and that was the end of it, the beginning of the Soviet Union.
Okay. Right.
It ended about 1922.
Okay, question from Tom. Charles and Vincent, a happy new year to you both. I'm very appreciative for Off the Menu. Look forward to it every week as a means of staying sane inside the insanity.
We try.
To all viewers, I highly recommend becoming a patron. It's a steal for twice the content.
Wow.
Well said. I love when people preface their question like that. This is important stuff Tom is mentioning. Thank you, Tom. Okay. Now to my question. Charles, would you please recommend some resources regarding antediluvian civilization? It's often said that our times are more sinful than those just before the deluge. So why not try to read up on it more? Thank you, and please say a prayer for me, my wife, and our son. God bless.
God bless you. Well, in the Father, and Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus.
Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners, now and at the hour of our death. Amen.
In the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, amen. Well, that's a very good question. You know, back in the 70s, when I was a teenager, there was a whole genre of books about, shall we say, alternative archaeology. Things like Eric von Däniken's Chariots of the Gods, Peter Colosimo's Timeless Earth, and all that. Well, I didn't have much use for their respective theories, but what certainly fascinated me was their collections of archaeological anomalies. You know, like an aluminum belt found in a Chinese tomb dating from some terribly remote year. Well, of course, you didn't have aluminum before the 19th century because there were no means to separate it. They hadn't been invented yet. There's no means to separate aluminum from its ore. The fact that this thing exists is an anomaly. It has no business being there. And any traces of an antediluvian civilization would be rather like that. To answer your question, I don't know of any book that really deals with this question from a Catholic or even a sane point of view. But there are a lot of books, as I say, especially from that era, that deal with all sorts of archaeological anomalies that may point to the existence of an antediluvian civilization. But the views advanced in them are very often crazy. So I don't think that the Nazca Plain or the Delhi Pillar or anything like that were built by space aliens.
Theoretically, was the Lost City of Atlantis antediluvian or post-diluvian?
Post-diluvian, presumably, because we don't know a lot about what happened after Noah. I mean, before Noah, I should say. But, of course, it could... I mean, who knows? If Atlantis existed, according to the ancient world's accounts, they were more advanced than they were, but that could mean anything. It's hard to know. I mean, don't get me wrong. When I was a kid, I was fascinated with both Lost Atlantis in the Atlantic and the lost continent of Mu in the Pacific. I didn't know it then any more than I do now. Even today, I love the phrase, you know, as vanished as lost Atlantis. And don't forget, there were two DC comics about Atlantis, Aquaman, and the Submariner. Or was the Submariner DC? Or was he Marvel?
Not a comic book person.
Well, that's that's one of these things I've got to find out. It'll keep me up all night. Marvel comics. So he was from Atlantis, and Aquaman was from Atlantis, but they were very... DC's Atlantis was very different from marvels in Lannis. And if that weren't enough, if you're familiar with Tarzan, one of the innumerable lost cities in Africa that Edgar Rice Burroughs created was the lost city of Opar, last colony of old Atlantis.
Where did El Dorado come from? Legend of El Dorado.
That's from Latin America. When the Spanish explorers came to Colombia, they heard legends of an Indian chief who would be covered in gold at his inauguration. And so he was called El Dorado, the Golden One, because he was covered with gold. And they sought, they searched for this figure. They never found him.
They heard that from the tribes.
Yeah. And not unlike what Coronado heard in the Southwest, you know, the lost cities of Quivira and so on. They'd say, oh, keep going. There's gold and jewels just down the horizon. Keep going. So you keep going.
What about, was it Ponce de Leon in the Fountain of Youth?
Yeah, he didn't find it.
How did that spawn, though?
Indian legends.
That's a fascinating one. I mean, Indian legends?
Fountain? You go to Florida now, huh?
Okay, but I don't know. That doesn't seem like an Indian legend, though. Like a type of Indian legend.
I don't know. All I can tell you is that if you go to Florida now, there are obviously lots of elderly people there trying to find that fountain and apparently not succeeding.
Okay. Question from James.
Okay.
What was the Disputation of Paris? I've heard it described as the Talmud on trial. What impact did it have, if any, on Christian-Jewish interactions during the Middle Ages and afterwards? Was the Talmud itself impacted by the findings of the disputation?
Well, back in the reign of King Louis IX, St. Louis, there was a convert from Judaism to Catholicism called Nicolas Dronin. And basically, at the time, when Catholics thought of Jews, they thought of them purely as people that followed the Old Testament. The Talmud was not really known by Catholics. The Talmud, just so you'll know, is commentary upon the scriptures. But it's a vast collection of stories and sayings and different things, legal texts. I mean, it's a real grab bag of stuff. And it has more... its legislation has more importance in Judaism as it's lived than really the Old Testament does. So Dronin brought this out, and he said it's filled with blasphemies, and it's horrible, and it needs to be destroyed. So the Jews did not feel that way, as you might imagine, and they selected four rabbis to debate with Dronin in front of King Louis IX. And this was the Disputation of Paris. Basically, I mean, like, for instance, there's a passage in the Talmud that says that Jesus is spending eternity drowning and excrement in hell.
That's not a commentary on the Old Testament.
No. They have a lot. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in the Talmud. It's a big grab bag. And so this was asserted to be blasphemy. The four rabbis asserted that the Jesus mentioned in the Talmud is not Jesus of Nazareth. As they said, any more than all Louis in France or Louis the King.
Well, why did they pick Jesus then? What, is there a line of Jesuses? I don't understand. That doesn't make sense.
It's a long story. Suffice to say, that's what their claim was. So, in the end, it was decided that the Talmud would be banned and burned. And so it was.
So, were there more objectionable things, or that was the main one?
There were other things. I mean, there were stories that Adam had had sex with animals, that kind of thing.
Okay, that's, wow. Okay.
There's the weird stuff in the Talmud, but I mean, you gotta understand that the Talmud is not, it's not like it was a centrally authored thing. It's filled, as I say, with stories, some of which are very good, some of which are very funny. It's got all sorts, it's a grab bag of stuff.
Okay. All right, final question today is from Logan.
All right.
Hope you both are having a merry and blessed Christmas season. My question, oh, yep, Charles is showing the tree. There we go. And, whoa, I think I'm going to be sick. Oh, there we go. Okay, the nativity scene. Okay. Yeah. A little, almost, I can't handle this. That's actually really scary. Please stop doing that, Charles. Stop doing that. Okay, thank you. Okay. For those just listening to the audio, don't worry about checking on YouTube. Nothing.
What?
Nothing to see here. Move along. All right. Wow. All right. So Logan says, my question is inspired by the question last episode about a profession in the military in the United States. Charles, does your answer change at all for those working in law enforcement at the local level? This also involves an oath to the Constitution, but U.S. policing is actually far from monolithic and retains some level of subsidiarity. Much is different from department to department. However, as you consistently point out, there is a crisis in leadership at all levels, both ecclesiastically and civilly. Officers are unfortunately asked to participate in enforcing unjust lockdowns, while also sometimes asked to stand down against the rioters and looters. I try to keep in mind the example of St. Maurice, head of a Roman legion under Emperor Diocletian, a society with morals perhaps on par with our own, who still pledged loyalty to his emperor and his people, yet refused, along with his whole legion, to offer incense to the pagan gods. I also keep in mind what his fate for doing so was. Martyrdom. Law enforcement is a profession increasingly difficult to abide in while living an integral Catholic life. Yet I do believe it is still a necessary profession for the common good of society, and that it is still possible to persevere in it without forsaking the faith, even given that oath. Anyway, please share your thoughts. You will both be in my prayers.
Well, especially in return for the promise of prayers, I certainly can't refuse. No, you bring up some very, very good points. I think that obviously the more local the setup and the saner, how do I put it? The more local the setup, the saner the local setup, the better your chances of being able to serve in law enforcement in that jurisdiction. But, you know, there's a danger. The whole country is slowly going to pieces. I mean, similarly, my remarks about the military, my fears regarding the military, may or may not be the same in states with state guards, for instance, depending on the nature of the state. The California State Military Reserve, or I guess it's been renamed the State Guard, I could be wrong. Anyway, very different. Serving there is a very, very different proposition from serving in the South Carolina Defense Force. Serving in the Governor's Foot Guards in Connecticut is different from serving the Cleveland Grays in Ohio. You know, you look at militia units that are outside the federal grasp. You look at local police and so on. There may be, you know, quite possible And certainly we need them. I mean, despite my my remarks concerning the popo at the beginning of the show, I certainly have a great appreciation for the people in law enforcement. And it's interesting, your comment about, on the one hand, being forced to enforce unjust laws, and then on the other, allowing rioters to play. You know, in those circumstances, I wish that the police could act as guides for the rioters, funneling them toward the mayor's house. You'd say, so the mayor could find out what it's like being burned out.
This question just reminded me of Obama's presidency.
Yeah.
We have such short-term memory. It's incredible.
I know.
I remember I had a friend who he was a really good Marine. He had a couple confirmed kills. He was a really tough dude. And or is a tough guy, and he became a police officer, and you know, he was scared. You know, he felt like, you know, I mean, policemen were kind of marked men for a while.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean. I mean, no, it felt like people didn't have their back. You know what I mean? Well, everybody's got a camera. Everybody's waiting to mess up. Everybody's pushing your buttons.
The black sheriff of Milwaukee said in the last year of President Obama's rule, he said, the President of the United States has declared war on law enforcement.
Now, my favorite policeman, Sheriff David Clark, the black guy with the cowboy hat. I love him.
Yeah, he was hardcore, heavy duty. But, I mean, that it was true. And, of course, I'm sure that President Harris will be more of the same.
That's rough, man. I pity our boys in blue in that kind of setup. That sucks.
It really does. You know, if you're going to do law enforcement, go to a small town in a state that isn't stupid. But not as stupid. I mean, if your idea of a good time is LAPD, one word, don't. NYPD, Minneapolis PD, Seattle PD, Portland PD. Guys, if I were you, I would say sayonara. If they wanted to fund you, beat them to it. To fund this moron. And then, you know, say bye-bye. Believe me, it might be tough at first, but your services are going to be increasingly required, especially in the private sector. Don't be surprised if our friends at Pinkerton have a real rebirth.
Yeah.
Well, you know, a lot of in the cities where the scumbag leadership have defunded the cops, you'll notice that the city councils and people like that are relying on private security. And, of course, the citizens could be fed to the dogs. While the moronic mayors and councilmen, you know, oh, it's so wonderful being wonderful. Just worthless, worthless slime. I mean, you look at somebody like Mayor de Blasio or Mayor Garcetti or the witches in Seattle and Portland. And you got to ask yourself, this is our brightest and best? These pathetic losers? I mean, there is a larger question at stake here, which is, how did we get here? Why are we having this conversation?
Well, I like how you said it on one episode where you were sort of venting, and you said, because we were talking about monarchy. We're ruled by these, in California, by the pack of idiots, and no one has the first clue on how to get rid of them.
Yep.
And how come we don't know how to get rid of them?
Well, of course, that's not entirely true. President Capone would have understood. Mr. Newsom, I understand you enjoy being governor.
You know, I really hope the strong man that we get isn't President Capone.
Well, he could be. See, that's the problem. You don't know what you're going to get. You don't know what you're going to get. You know, Governor Newsom, I'm inviting you to a barbecue. It's your dog. If you don't want anything else barbecued, I would suggest you resign.
Wow.
Well, you remember the famous thing in The Godfather, the horse head being left to the guys.
Of course.
The guys, yeah. This apropos of nothing, but I belong to something called the Mythopoeic Society, and every year, not this year, of course, but in normal years, we have something called MythCon, and there's a fantasy writer who's the major guest. One year, it was Peter S. Beagle, who wrote The Last Unicorn, and that was a particularly fun convention, and Beagle is a particularly amusing guy, but one of the customs that we'll do every year is what's called food sculpture, where something will take the food at the banquet and make scenes referring to the person's work.
Okay.
So what we did with Peter Beagle was we made a unicorn head bleeding because he wrote The Last Unicorn. And we offered it to him as an offer he couldn't refuse.
Wow. That's pretty dark.
The mafia brought him a unicorn head. You know, Mr. Beagle, you might want to reconsider your business practices.
Wow. All right, well.
You know, someone sent me a note that, I won't say they attacked me, but they said, you know, everybody you talk about except your precious French Canadians, you turn into caricatures. Italian mafiosi, Irish drugs, and on and on and on. And I can only say one thing to that.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the whole point of ethnic humor is to use ethnic stereotypes. But there's something we have to remember about ethnic stereotypes. There's a reason they survive. They're not absolutely true. But they're true enough that people recognize them. To put this another way, why is it old people are always portrayed as either bald or gray-headed?
Because it's mostly true.
Yeah, not all is true. Ronald Reagan is the proof. But, you know, I've got actually a classmate from high school, Ron Manson. His hair is black. It's as black as when we were in school. Amazing. He doesn't dye it.
Okay.
Well, you say it's okay. Look at my hair. It's white. And let me tell you something else. I told you what they call my color hair in German.
What?
Did I tell you this?
No.
Friedhof blond.
What is that?
Graveyard blonde.
Graveyard blonde.
Graveyard blonde. And that, as soon as I heard that, I had this vision of an ad for television. You see this really beautiful chick with gold hair come out. She goes, I'm a butter blonde. Tosses her head and says, I'm going to the beauty parlor. And off she goes. This other girl, sort of reddish hair, comes out and says, I'm a strawberry blonde. Tosses her head. I'm going to the beauty parlor. Goes on. Third girl, she says, I'm a platinum blonde, tosses her head. I'm going to the beauty parlor, walks off. Then I come out. I'm a graveyard blonde. I'm going to the Undertaker.
Wow.
I don't know what we'd be advertising, but I don't think it's a product or a service that would sell very well after that. Do you?
I don't think so.
You don't see me with these three chicks as a pitch person?
I don't know. It's hard to imagine. I don't know if I want to imagine it so vividly.
You think my addition to the mix somehow takes away from its salesworthiness?
I think it would definitely grab people's attention and that they would remember the ad, but I don't know if it would. I don't know if it would gain trust.
Trust.
Yeah, see, you can't trust people nowadays anymore, you know?
Who needs trust when our masters have our submission?
Ooh. That's true.
Yeah, we obey.
That's very true. Yeah.
You know what the great political motto of our country is going to be over the next decade?
What?
Please don't hurt me again.
Wow.
Speaking of hurting us again, after you see this, ladies and gentlemen, there will be a week between this show and the next one, as is our custom. In between will be January the 6th, the Feast of the Epiphany, the Three Kings. Now, this is one of my favorite holidays. I love the Epiphany. I love it for several reasons. I love the Three Kings. If we were in a normal year, since I'm stuck in Europe, I'd have gone to Cologne to spend the Epiphany at their shrine. Wouldn't that have been nice?
Mm-hmm.
However, I can neither leave Austria nor can I go to Germany, so I'm not going to be doing that. But, there are three things that are commemorated in the Epiphany. Visit of the Three Kings, the turning of the water into the wine at Cana, and the baptism of our Lord in the Jordan. Now, we commemorate all three. The Byzantines and the Orthodox commemorate only the baptism of the Jordan. So, they have a very, very elaborate ceremony of the blessing of the water for the Epiphany. And it is very much like our blessing of the holy water font on Holy Saturday. Very, very similar. We, on the other hand, we have a blessing of water in the Latin Rite, and also of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. But in addition to those blessings, we have the blessing of chalk. And it's better if you get the priest to come to your house and write on your door the year, in this case, 20 plus CMB, Caspar, Melchior, Balthazar, 20. And then go through the house, blessing it with holy water and reciting prayers. But if you can't get him to do that, you can just take the blessed chalk and do it yourself. But that's a big thing to do for the Epiphany. It's also a good time to ditch the Christmas tree. But any other decorations you've got that, you don't want to turn your house into a fire hazard, but any other decorations you've got for Christmas that won't do that, keep them up until Candlemas Eve. Christmas lasts until then. 12 days are coming through soon to a close, but we're moving on to Candlemas. However, this year, the year 2021 under the old system, the year 2 PDE, we are having an excitement in Washington. The election will be certified or not. More and more, of course, we're hearing about an attempt to avoid it on procedural grounds and have the House do it. I have no idea whether or not that's going to happen or going to succeed or even going to be tried, but it's the last possibility of avoiding a Harris administration, and it may not even be a possibility. We'll see. But at the same time, Mr. Trump has called for a vast rally in D.C. And so, we'll see what happens. You know, as I'm sitting here this very moment, a thought comes to me. And that is, I wonder if Mr. Trump will try to do to the Harris administration over the next 4 years what they did to him. That is, make their lives as unpleasant as possible in every way he can.
I hope so. You know, that's one thing Obama kind of did, where he kind of broke precedent, where George Bush and Clinton and, you know, previous presidents.
Everybody.
You don't get involved, right? You've been president. Yeah, now, yeah. Obama didn't do that, and that's crap. So now let's give it a little poke. Let's poke them a little bit, huh? But no. Yeah, they don't like being poked now.
Oh. Well, no, because now they'll be the government, and we've got to show respect to the president of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, it was always that way. You remember when Bush Jr. was in, he was constantly being ridiculed and so on. And then as soon as Obama came in, oh, he's the president of the United States. You've got to show respect to the office. Well, you know, whatever. Certainly it's going to be an exciting time ahead of us. And I wouldn't be too worried about it, ladies and gentlemen, for two important reasons. One, it's only the backdrop against which we have to work out our salvation, which is the most important thing. Eternity in heaven, rather than eternity in hell. Everything else is secondary to that. And second, try not to get too upset over a pack of morons anyway. Hmm. I mean, I remember the stand-up comedian in Romania in the 40s, 30s and 40s of the last century. He was very, very popular, very, very funny, always poking fun at everything. And he was so funny and so popular that even Antonescu, who was the pro-German strongman in Romania, didn't dare touch him, even though he made remorseless fun of Antonescu. He was too popular to touch. So then the communists come in, and he's doing the same thing to them. Then one night, in the middle of a performance, a secret policeman comes in and says to him, "Stop doing it, or you're a dead man." And he laughed at him, you know, and he went out. And he kept doing it. And a couple of weeks later, another secret policeman comes in and shoots him right on stage in front of everybody. So he's lying there dying, and he looks at the man and shot him. He said, "Okay, so you killed me. You're still idiots. Killing me is not going to change the fact that you're worthless scumbags." I mean, and he literally died laughing. Can you imagine what it must have been like being that secret policeman to have your victim dying laughing at you?
I hope that haunted him for the rest of his life.
I hope so too.
And I hope he learned from it.
And beyond. And beyond, I hope. All right, I hope he repented before he died. Okay.
There. Yeah. That's more like it, Charles.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to be beaten again. I'll be good this time. But no, so ladies and gentlemen, you know, in the immortal words of Barbara Streisand, God help us, my mind is going, Betty Davis, fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride.
Okay. So that will do it for this episode. Remember, everyone, if it's Monday.
It's, no, don't help me. I work alone, please. It's off the menu.
And the soul you save.
It definitely will be your hope.